Hey guys, you know what this playground could use? A wine country, huh?
A redwood forest would be cool.
Ski slopes!
Wait! Did we just invent California?
Discover why California is the ultimate playground at visitcalifornia.com.
The wait is almost over. Get ready for the 2024 NFL season as the full schedule is announced. Bring it! Every rivalry, every rematch, every rookie debut, every game revealed. The 2024 NFL Schedule Release, presented by Verizon, coming in May. Live on NFL Network, ESPN2, and streaming on NFL Plus. Terms and conditions apply to NFL Plus. Visit NFL.com/schedule-release to learn more.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring, but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.
Hey, this is Christina Quinn. I'm the host of Try This, the Washington Post's new series of audio courses. The idea behind Try This is to become better functioning humans without having to comb the internet for countless hours. In our first course, we learned how to sleep better. Now, we're going to learn how to make our friendships stronger. I'll offer expert tips that are doable, and I'll keep it short. So let's do this. Class is in session. Find Try This from the Washington Post wherever you listen.
This audio is from a daily ceremony that takes place between India and Pakistan that started in 1959. It is held at the Wagha border, the most prominent border crossing between these two countries. The last time I was in Pakistan was 3 years ago. On that trip, I witnessed the Wagha border ceremony. My family and I were visiting Lahore, located in the province of Punjab, which was a major area of conflict during partition. Lahore is located only 50 miles away from India, and my experience at the border was unforgettable. From iHeartRadio, I'm Neha Aziz, and this is Partition, a podcast that will take a closer look into this often forgotten part of history. My family's last trip to Pakistan was for 3 weeks. This gave us time to explore more parts of the country, and Lahore was high on the list. It is filled with stunning architecture dating back to the Mughal Empire. I love Karachi. After all, it's where I was born. But in terms of culture, Lahore has my birthplace beat. We do have amazing food, though. While outlining our travel plans, my dad mentioned a ceremony. Confused, I asked what he was talking about. He told me that every evening, a military event between India and Pakistan takes place. This ceremony was one of the first things we saw when we arrived in Lahore, and it was the epitome of a spectacle. During our visit, the air was filled with smog, which made our journey to get there all the more formidable. Cars were only allowed so far, and we eventually had to walk the rest of the way to the stadium where the ceremony would take place. On the way, we had to go through numerous security checkpoints. As we made our way to the entrance, I tried to get my bearings. Walking along the crowd to get to the stadium was just very bizarre. I'm not sure how long we were walking for, but it felt like at least 45 minutes. We were walking on the same roads where absolute carnage took place over 70 years ago. A shiver ran down my spine. The majority of people I saw were filled with excitement and anticipation to witness this tradition. I only noticed a handful of people realize the melancholy of where we were and what we were doing. Both sides of the road were fenced off with barbed wire, indicating that the other side was Indian territory. The land beyond the fence seemed vast and endless. I turned to my mom and said, "Is this the closest I will ever get to India?" She didn't give me a verbal response, but instead gave me a look that conveyed all I needed to know. As we continued our journey, I couldn't help noticing the amount of school children that were there. I saw many different uniforms. I wanted to ask if they were from a local or nearby school, or did they travel from other provinces? I wondered what they were taught about the continuous strife between these two places. I didn't really know how to feel during the ceremony. At its core, it's a daily military practice for the Indian and Pakistani armies. A 45-minute long sequence of marches and songs. It's spoken of as a display of cooperation and brotherhood between these two nations. In person, it was almost like a scene straight out of Gladiator. Thunderous claps and cheering, performers, flag waving, snacks being sold. Did my family and I buy some popcorn? Absolutely. But did it make the concept any less strange? Not at all. The performance has two parts, the beating retreat and the changing of the guard, performed by the India Border Security Force and the Pakistan Rangers. Our respective sides were separated by two gates that open and close during this theatrical production. Indian and Pakistani soldiers march in perfect unison. The flags of both countries are lowered, and they partake in puffery and intimidation. Think of a male peacock trying to attract a mate. The Pakistan Rangers wear black uniforms, while the Indian Border Security Force wears khaki uniforms, with both sides sporting pops of color. These colors demanded attention with every hand raise and leg kick. The gates first open as the sun sets. The flags are folded after they are lowered, and a no-nonsense handshake takes place to conclude the end of the ceremony. After the handshakes, the iron gates of the border close again. During the entire event, visitors sing their national anthems and chant slogans of Pakistan Zindabad, which means long live the land of pure, or victory to Pakistan, and Jai Hind, victory to India, long live India across the way. As I sat in the stadium, letting everything in front of me sink in, I couldn't help but think, what were we all supposed to take away from this? Is it all fun and games, or does it build antagonism? The idea behind it is to symbolize respect in addition to rivalry between the two nations, but ultimately, it's a source of national and patriotic pride. There is no shame in being proud of your heritage and where you come from, but I think it's important to realize that our identities are so entwined with each other. One does not exist without the other. Our culture, language, food, and countless other entities are cut from the same cloth. Yet decades later, there is so much anger, bias, and hurt. As I've said again and again, partition continues to haunt our daily lives. I ask how these two governments can have a daily ceremony together, a ceremony that started over 60 years ago when their relationships with each other are so troubled. I'm sorry, but you cannot have a ceremony that represents respect and friendship when Indian and Pakistani people are barred from visiting the other country just because of where they were born and familial ties. As I discuss a little later, it wasn't always like this. This illusion of friendship, which is really a disguise for hateful policies and violent rivalry stemming from the British-made border, made me think of something I noticed when my family and I began to walk towards the stadium. In the distance, I could see both India's and Pakistan's flags waving in the wind. My dad noticed I was looking at them and said that India had put up a flag first and Pakistan followed suit, but purposely made their flag higher than theirs. I asked if he was kidding. It slipped my mind to look this up at the time, but when writing this episode, I did, and he definitely was not kidding. In March of 2017, India put up a flag that was 360 feet tall. 5 months later, Pakistan decided to put up a flag of their own, but at 400 feet. The Hindustan Times reported in July of 2021 that India plans to create an even larger flag, one that is 50 feet higher than the current one they have in place, making it 10 feet taller than Pakistan's. And I'm sure once that happens, Pakistan will make a larger one, and the madness will continue. There are some, I'm sure, who see this news and feel a deep sense of pride, or find it comical. I personally can't help but see it as a waste of time, energy, and money when there are real needs to be addressed. The majority of our conversations on the border have dealt with how difficult it is for many Indians and Pakistanis to visit the other side. But why? And what other underlying issues cause each government to deny visa applications from people of the other country? Since partition, India and Pakistan continue to have deeply tense relations. Both countries have nuclear weapons and continue to fight over Kashmir, even with numerous wars already under their belts. It should be noted that the dispute over Kashmir and other tensions between these nations are very intricate and complex. So for the purposes of this episode, I'll be using a handful of examples to illustrate how tensions between the two countries manifest today.
My research interests are about refugees and borders in South Asia. And so as a consequence of that, I'm obviously interested in partition.
That is Dr. Antara Datto, an historian and professor of international relations at Royal Holloway University in London. I wanted to ask her about the border from more of an historical lens. I first asked her about these borders over the last 75 years. They have gone through different periods of accessibility. I have a picture of my fraternal grandparents in front of the Taj Mahal in the 60s, shortly after my dad was born. The likelihood of that picture being taken in 2022 is extremely small.
First of all, the kind of whole visa and passport regime has a much longer history. So in order to understand where that comes from, I think you actually have to go back to partition. And both India and Pakistan trying to work out, as I said, who belongs and who doesn't. And in that process, two things emerge, a permit system first, and then a passport system. So before the visas, there came passports for these people, right? And why did these systems emerge? The permit system really emerges because many Muslims who go to Pakistan want to come back to India. And the Indian government is worried because many of these people have left property behind, property that the Indian government calls evacuee property, and was going to hand this over to Hindus and Sikhs. So if these Muslims come back and claim this property, that causes a problem. So they make them apply for permits. And the permits that are given to Muslims are different to the permits that are given to Hindus and Sikhs in this period. So although ostensibly Nehru has declared India to be a secular state, there is a difference in the way in which Hindus and Muslims are crossing this border, even in 1947.
Nehru was the first Prime Minister of India.
The passport system, interestingly, is introduced at the behest of Pakistan. Well, not quite at the behest of Pakistan, but Pakistan has a greater hand in the passport system. And the reason they introduce it is because actually they are overwhelmed by the number of Muslims who are coming into Pakistan. And in order to stop that flow, they introduce another document that would make people's lives harder and more difficult. And the way this plays out in the next sort of few decades is that both countries see crossing this border or acquiring this passport as a sign that you have made a choice. But again, as I said to you in answer to an earlier question, people's lives are complicated. So some people cross the border, they make a choice, and then they want to turn the clock back. Or they acquire a passport, and then they say, no, but we want to go back. We want to either claim property or we're not happy here. We want to go back to our old life. And so if you look at sort of Indian constitutional records, as well as court cases, there are many, many of these court cases about people who are trying to claim citizenship, trying to claim passports, usually Muslims, who may have made decisions to go back and then come back again. So this history gets very, very messy.
Much like any situation in which there are disputes between countries and governments, it all boils down to who is in charge.
So you have this regime of permits and passports that's first of all creating this border. Then over the next sort of few decades, whether the border is open or closed, as you rightly said, is often a question of geopolitics. It's, you know, down to who's in power, who's not in power. You know, so there was at one point a bus that went to Lahore. There was a train that went to Dhaka, right? So there's this kind of bus diplomacy. There are trains on the eastern side of the border. And then every so often something happens like the Kargil War and these are shut down. You know, so there are moments in which diplomacy opens up these borders and moments in which the borders are closed.
The Kargil War took place for over 2 months in 1999, and it is one of the wars between India and Pakistan over land in Kashmir.
But what I think is really interesting about these borders themselves, and I did say earlier that we should think about the borders as not just physical objects, but if we just see them as physical objects, as people kind of stamping your passport as you cross a border and so on and so forth, is that actually, as I said, the border in the West has always been harder to cross. And in fact, there was a time when post did not go across the border. So if you posted a parcel from India to Pakistan, it went to Dubai, right? So you paid a crazy amount of money. But as I said, the border in the East used to be open for a much longer period of time. But that border has now been militarized. There is now a barbed wire fence, and India has been in the process of kind of creating a wall there. So the discourse around the border, around who is allowed to cross the border, has also changed. Whereas once upon a time, that eastern border would have been relatively easy to cross. There used to be something called an Indo-Bangladesh passport, for instance, that you could simply use to cross that border. So Hindus who had families either in Bangladesh or were living in Bangladesh and had families in India could simply use an Indo-Bangladesh passport and vice versa to cross that border. That passport was abolished, I believe, in 2013 or something.
Anthura points out what happens within these countries is just as important as what is happening outside of them.
And I will argue that the opening and closing of those borders is not just about, you know, who's in power and so on, but it's also to do with internal politics, right? About minorities, particularly in India. And again, if you look east, as that border was created, that militarized, fenced border, that has gone hand in hand with the writing of a new Citizenship Act. A new Citizenship Act that kind of goes back on earlier conceptions of secularism and now makes India a home for South Asia's Hindus and Sikhs quite explicitly.
In episode one, I said that India would be home to the Hindu-Sikh majority, but it would also be more secular than Pakistan. As Anthura says, the amendment to the Citizen Act has removed this notion. The Citizenship Amendment Bill was designed to amend the Citizenship Act of 1955 to recognize specific types of immigrants segregated by religion and country of origin. Under the Citizens Amendment Act, Buddhists, Christians, Hindus, Jains, Parsis, and Sikhs who had migrated from Afghanistan, Bangladesh, or Pakistan to India prior to 2014 are no longer considered illegal immigrants and have a better chance to obtain citizenship. However, notably, Jews and Muslims are left out of the amendment, which makes this a prejudiced policy against the religions of Islam and Judaism in India. This legislation led to protests all around India for its blatant exclusion of minority faiths.
Hey guys, you know what this playground could use? A wine country, huh?
A redwood forest would be cool.
Ski slopes!
Wait! Did we just invent California?
Discover why California is the ultimate playground at visitcalifornia.com.
Like many of us, you might think identity theft will never happen to you. But consider this. There's a new identity theft victim every 3 seconds in the U.S. That's over 15 million people by the end of this year. Equal to the populations of New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago combined. Even worse, identity theft victims often don't even know they're victims. That's why LifeLock Identity Theft Protection alerts you to identity threats, even the ones that don't show up on a credit report, like data breaches, fraudulent bank transactions, loan and credit card applications, and crimes committed in your name. If your identity is stolen, your own dedicated LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will work to fix it. LifeLock protects you in ways that you simply can't on your own. Join now and save up to 25% your first year at LifeLock.com/news. That's LifeLock.com/news to save up to 25%. Identity theft protection starts here.
The wait is almost over. Get ready for the 2024 NFL season as the full schedule is announced. Bring it! Every rivalry, every rematch, every rookie debut, every game revealed. The 2024 NFL schedule release, presented by Verizon, coming in May. Live on NFL Network, ESPN2, and streaming on NFL Plus. Terms and conditions apply to NFL Plus. Visit NFL.com/schedule release to learn more.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring, but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.
So I would say these questions around who is allowed to get a visa, who is not, when these open up, are also a product of domestic politics. And these domestic calculations around which minorities are seen to be legitimate and, you know, how we can make people's lives more difficult internally has an impact on external border crosses.
All of these rules and regulations get further complicated because not only is this accessibility based on yourself and your faith, but also where your parents and grandparents are from.
If you are applying for a visa to India, but your parent or your grandparent was born in what is today Pakistan, that's a much more complicated process, right? There are extra forms to fill out. This isn't just about your passport or your nationality. There is a sort of grandfathering, grandmothering of these clauses. And again, that's deliberate.
The idea of identity politics really comes into play as more time passes.
But what's interesting is that in the 2000s, India introduces an overseas Indian citizenship. It introduces a person of Indian origin card and then an overseas Indian citizenship. And the way that legislation is written is very interesting because technically most Pakistanis or many Pakistanis would be eligible to become persons of Indian origin or overseas Indian citizens, right? That piece of Indian legislation is primarily kind of directed at the wealthy diaspora to try and get money back. Clearly, you know, some countries like Fiji, etc., which saw indentured labor from India, were excluded from that list, right? But also, it was specifically written to exclude Pakistan and Bangladesh and so on, so that, you know, people from those countries could not claim overseas Indian citizenship status, right? And so for me, I think a lot of these conversations are really, really connected. These conversations about border crossing, the conversations about diasporic South Asians, as well as conversations within India about minorities. I think these are always intimately and intricately linked.
All of my grandparents were born in India, which makes me a person of Indian origin. I can trace this fact back several generations, I'm sure. But because they were forced to move during partition, and I was subsequently born in Pakistan, this legislation does not apply to me.
I think a lot of people, as I said, in 1947 made a bunch of choices not knowing what the long-term consequences of those choices would be or not expecting the long-term consequences of those choices to be what they turned out to be and the ways in which it would be very hard to turn the clock back. We also have to think in terms of privilege. I think about this a lot when I think about personal histories of partition and the subcontinent because the histories that have been written and the histories that have been told are so overwhelmingly upper class and upper caste. Right? The vast majority of the people who moved were working class people. And they had fewer options than many of the upper class people who moved across these borders, right? So how you moved across the border, what you took with you, and then what happened to you after you crossed the border was very closely linked to your social status before you crossed the border. So even those Punjabis in particular who came across and who had very little, but who belonged to a certain social strata or who had the education or who had the connections, were able to thrive in a way that many working class people struggle to do so. And we know that that is particularly true of the Dalit community that moved from Eastern Bengal into West Bengal.
Anthara mentioned the Dalit community, individuals belonging to the lowest caste.
We're at a point where we're collecting all of these partition stories, where we're almost sort of curating partition for the next generation. But whose stories are we curating? There's some really interesting work that shows that both India and Pakistan wrote their Dalit citizens out of their histories, but were panicked because many of these citizens did everyday jobs that the two new countries needed people to do. So tried to retain them desperately while at the same time writing them out of their histories. When we step back and we look at these broader histories, gender, class, caste, religion, all of these are so closely intertwined in how we understand, you know, not just border crossing in 1947, but what happens to those people in the next 75 years.
We go on to discuss refugees and their treatment in a new place. I shouldn't have been shocked to learn that who is and isn't considered a refugee also leaned into the notion of identity politics.
I think that's a really important history of partition, that people didn't just cross a border and become seamlessly integrated into the new nation state, right? And India and Pakistan both refused to sign the 1951 UN Convention on Refugees, which defines who a refugee is. And the reason they refused to do that has to do with the Eurocentric nature of it, has to do with the fact that it defined refugees as emerging from the war in Europe and so on and so forth. But the consequences of India and Pakistan not signing that, they've still never signed it, is that these people who cross the border are known as various things. Sometimes they're refugees. Sometimes they're displaced persons in official discourse. Sometimes they're migrants. And a lot of this is to do with how they are then treated. So we know from the existing literature, for instance, that the Punjabi refugees are seen as genuine refugees because the Indian government argues they fled violence and they are hardworking and we deserve to give them compensation and rehabilitation. Whereas these Bengalis are lazy and they did not flee the same kind of violence that the Punjabis fled from. So somehow their kind of claim to refugeehood is less authentic. And then they claim that therefore they don't deserve the same degree of rehabilitation. But of course, people keep coming. And eventually the Indian state tries to resettle them in some of these quite badly thought through rehabilitation schemes in central India, which fail because you can't just move people to arid land and expect them to cultivate it overnight. But then that's further seen as proof that these Bengalis only want charity. They're not hardworking like the Punjabis and therefore truly deserving of rehabilitation. So groups of people who cross borders at the same time, their fates can turn out to be very different depending on who they are, where they cross the border, and the communities into which they cross into, right? And so those stories are really, really quite complex.
Over the past few weeks, you've heard several stories about people and their homes getting left behind. And I wanted to know if Anthara thought if there could be a time where maybe the process for everyone to visit these countries would be easier.
Forced border crossing in South Asia is traumatic. I mean, forced border crossing everywhere is traumatic. But there are some truly traumatic stories in South Asia. And that's 1947, that's 1971. There are expulsions of stateless people in South Asia. There's kind of ongoing trauma of the Rohingyas. And so these stories are never going to end in some ways, right? And in a way, I think that the kind of individual reconciliations were subsumed within both India and Pakistan's original intention to almost sort of erase partition, right? You know, we didn't have a partition museum in India till very recently. And Independence Day in 14th of August in Pakistan, 15th of August in India, is always focused on independence and then displaying your military hardware, rather than the trauma of partition. And that was a completely deliberate choice, right? To erase some of those histories, to subsume them within this broader narrative. So a sort of macrocosm of what happens at the Wagha Atari border, right? If you think of it that way. So that's one of the reasons why those individual stories have been kind of lost or don't get priority. And you were asking what the kind of the future of this might be like and what we can hope for. And I can't predict that future. But, you know, we know that every time there is upheaval in South Asia, it creates more forced migration across borders. And, you know, we know that for a fact. And in general, theoretically, I like to think of borders as entirely artificial constructs, right? And as someone who's lived on kind of three continents, I was born on one continent, my children were born on a different continent. We spent a lot of time in North America. For me, border crossing has always been an everyday part of my life. It's been an expensive part of my life, but in the grand scheme of things, my privilege has made it not that stressful. Stressful, but if I'm honest, not that stressful, right? Whereas for a lot of people in South Asia, crossing these borders, and if you again look at the kind of India-Bangladesh border, for people, this is a question of their livelihood. And every time they cross that border, they take their life into their own hands in order to make ends meet. So for me, I don't see an end to the ways in which these borders have become securitized. I don't think we're ever going to roll the clock back on that.
75 years of violence and turmoil is a lot to unpack. It's hard to imagine where you would even begin to have this conversation. Both governments are aware of what the people of India and Pakistan had to bear when it came to partition, and continuously closing off these borders is truly an awful way to repay them. There is no time like the present to make amends for the past. Our next episode will be our last. These past 9 weeks, you've heard interviews from survivors, historians, artists, and other creatives discuss how partition is a part of them. But where do we go from here? How can we take all of these thoughts and discussions and turn them into actions? How has this tragedy taught us about what is currently going on in the world? Education and empathy are at the heart of all these questions. Until next week, I'm Neha Aziz, and this is Partition. Partition was developed as a part of the Next Up initiative created by Anna Hosnier, Joelle Monique, and Yesenia Median. Partition is produced by Anna Hosnier, Trisha Mukherjee, and Becca Ramos. It is edited by Rory Gagan with original score composed by Mark Hadley.
Hey guys, you know what this playground could use? A wine country, huh?
A redwood forest would be cool.
Ski slopes!
Wait!
Did we just invent California?
Discover why California is the ultimate playground at visitcalifornia.com.
The wait is almost over. Get ready for the 2024 NFL season as the full schedule is announced. Bring it! Every rivalry, every rematch, every rookie debut, every game revealed. The 2024 NFL Schedule Release, presented by Verizon, coming in May. Live on NFL Network, ESPN2, and streaming on NFL Plus. Terms and conditions apply to NFL Plus. Visit NFL.com/schedule-release to learn more.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring, but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you, from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.
Xumo Play is your destination for endless entertainment. With a diverse lineup of 350-plus live channels, movies, and full TV series, you'll easily find something to watch right away. And the best part? It's all free. Love music? Get lost in the 90s with iHeart 90s, dance away with hip-hop beats, and more on the iHeart Radio music channels. No logins, no signups, no accounts, no hassle. So what are you waiting for? Start streaming at play.xumo.com or download from the app and Google Play stores today. All you can stream with Xumo Play.